Yes, what am I going to do without the overhead? I will do what I did for decades before they came along. I want to talk with you this morning about a question. Who is Christ? Who is Jesus? I want to think about that with you for a few minutes this morning. This question was of great importance in Jesus' day. I mean, you would expect it to be that way, would you not? If he came today instead of back then, everybody would be buzzing around saying, well, who is he? Well, what is he? What do you think he is? In John chapter 7, in connection with the Feast of the Tabernacles, Jesus came to the city, and at first he didn't come. Everybody was wondering where he was. It says in verse 12, let's say verse 11, the Jews therefore sought him at the feast and said, where is he? And there was much murmuring among the multitude concerning him. Some said, he is a good man. Others said, not so, but he leadeth the multitude astray. Now, do you see right there? We see there was a diversity of opinion about who Jesus was. And some were saying, he's a good man. Others said, not so, but he leadeth the multitudes astray. Jesus asked his disciples, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Matthew 16 is the context. And they said, John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Matthew 16, verse 14. Now these were the answers from the ones who did not know Jesus. Both the answer in John 7 and verse 12 and the answer that the disciples were telling Jesus in Matthew 16, 14. That was coming from people who did not know him very well. Now I want you to make sure and let that register. See, the uncertainty was on the part of those who did not know Jesus very well. His own apostles, however, when he said, but who do you say that I, the Son of Man, am? They replied, you are the Son of the living God. You see, they knew who he was. And they knew by their constant association with him. They were with him all the time. And instead of being repulsed by their intimate knowledge of Jesus, his disciples who knew him best were his most fervent defenders. Now, if you'll just think about human nature, if someone is bragged on a great deal to you, and you say, well, that person must be just absolutely perfect. And then you spend some time with that person and you may find out that, yeah, they're good, they're really good, but they're not perfect. But when the disciples were with Jesus and they were as susceptible to what everybody else was saying as anyone would be, but when they were with Jesus, their view, their opinion was, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And you remember that the first two that went and actually talked with him were Andrew and John in John chapter 1. The same John that wrote the book of John. He and Andrew were among the first to have a conversation with Jesus. And the result of that was an undying, unceasing faith that he was the Son of God. So today I want to ask the question to you, who is Jesus? And I want to give some answers to that. Number one, Jesus is someone who was promised. You know, there are many people in this earth who was promised before they were even thought of. I looked up an article yesterday on my computer on Buddha. And I found out that Buddha wasn't really just the name of some man. That the word Buddha means an enlightened one. An enlightened one. And there was this fellow that was born 600 and something B.C., and he became the greatest Buddha, the greatest enlightened one. And there are stories told about when he was conceived, that his mother had a dream of a white elephant and so on. But there was no book. There was no book that existed before Buddha came, going back, covering time, going back thousands of years, in which the coming of Buddha was promised. When Muhammad showed up in the 6th century, there was no book that was predicting in intimate detail the coming of Muhammad. But Jesus was promised. And He was promised very first thing in the Bible. In Genesis 3 and verse 15, God said to the devil, He said, I'm going to put enmity between your seed and her seed, or between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He is going to bruise your head. You are going to bruise His heel. And I agree, if that's all we had, we wouldn't have much to go on. But when you put that with all the other promises and information that we have, we can trace the promises all the way through the Old Testament relating to this one that was to come. When God called Abraham around 2000 B.C. in Ur of the Chaldees, that was a long time ago. We're talking about 4,000 years ago. And God called Abraham and He said, Abraham, I will make of you a great nation. I'm going to bless all families of the earth in you. Now later on, He elaborated that promise somewhat, like in Genesis 22:18, saying, through your seed. So it will not be through Abraham personally, but through one of the descendants of Abraham, He was going to bless all nations of the earth. So there were these promises. Jesus was one who was promised. And from that point on, He was one who was coming. So when Martha confronted Jesus at the resurrection, the time that Lazarus was raised from the dead, Jesus asked her, do you believe, Martha? And she said, yea, Lord, I have believed that Thou art the one coming into the world. Do you know why she said that? She said that because Jesus was one who was promised. So you want to know who Jesus is? He was the one who was promised. And not many people can say that. He was promised. Not only that, He was foretold. He was foretold. He was prophesied. There were things, signs, and things like that that were prophesied of Him. And of course, we could just spend our whole time doing nothing but going over those prophecies. But one was Isaiah 7 and verse 14. Behold, the virgin shall conceive, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call His name Emmanuel. Matthew quotes this in Matthew chapter 1, and he says, and they shall call His name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. This is Isaiah 7:14. In that context, Isaiah mentions Emmanuel more than once. In chapter 9, verses 6 and 7, Isaiah says, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon His shoulder, and His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, who do you think that would be? There isn't any similar thing that you can compare to this. Jesus was prophesied. And He was prophesied over and over again. Turn with me for a moment in your Bible to Isaiah 53. And as we turn to Isaiah 53, I want to look at this passage, spend a few moments here. And the context of this passage as a messianic passage begins in chapter 52 and verse 13. So I want you to look at something here now. It's a simple thing. As you look at the last paragraph in chapter 52, you have verses 13, 14, and 15. Now, are you listening? In these verses, the simple point is made that the coming of the Christ would be a surprising thing. There would be surprising things about it, that he would not be what one would expect. He would startle the nations. Kings will shut their mouths at him. It's going to be surprising. Then in chapter 53, notice something else. Verses 1, 2, and 3. How convenient. It breaks up into groups of three verses each. In these three verses, it's an incredible thing. Who has believed our message? Who will believe our report? Verse 2, he grew up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness. When we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their face. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. How powerful. Again, the idea that he was not what men expected. That he came up like if you had, you ever seen an area where there was just packed clay. Bare, packed clay. And you think, well, that dirt is just dead. It's just dead, sterile dirt. And then to your surprise, here comes a plant poking up out of it. A root out of dry ground. And there's nothing in him that you would look at and say, oh, wow, this guy has charisma. So he doesn't appeal to anybody because of his charisma. I have an idea that if we had actually been able to see Jesus personally and physically, we would have said, that is Jesus. I have an idea we would have said that. He would have looked so ordinary. And we esteemed him not. The next little paragraph, verses 4, 5, and 6. Again, three verses. What's the point? The things that he suffered for us. Listen to this. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. That's how we thought. We thought he was smitten of God. Yes, that was what the people of his day did think. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Here is in the utmost clear language the fact that this one is a sacrifice. He's dying for others. Then in verses 7 through 9, the next three verses, the manner of his death, it was not just, it was not right, it was not fair. He was oppressed, and yet look at his conduct. He opened not his mouth. As a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep that before its shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who among them considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due? He came and died for the very people who killed him. By the way, in the back of your mind, whom are you thinking of? In the back of your mind as we read this passage, whom are you thinking of? You are thinking of Jesus because of how detailed this passage is in describing him and what happened to him. They made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, though he had done no violence, neither was any deceit found in his mouth. And then in the last three verses, on a very upbeat note, the good results that come from what he did. It pleased the Lord. In other words, it didn't please the Lord merely to see Jesus suffer, but it pleased him to see him suffer because of what that suffering would accomplish. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. Seed there doesn't mean that Jesus would literally have children. But it is talking about his followers, his disciples, and so on. Jesus was prophesied. And this chapter, written over 700 years before Jesus came, was written of him. And it could not apply to anyone else. Micah wrote in Micah 5 and verse 2, "But thou, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though thou art little to be numbered among the thousands of Judah, nevertheless out of thee shall one come forth unto me to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting," and on and on. Who is Jesus? He is one who was promised. He is one who was prophesied. Turning back now to John chapter 11. Who is Jesus? Who was Jesus when he was upon the earth? John 11. Look at verse 47. John 11, 47. Jesus is someone that even his enemies admitted that he did miracles. Now ponder that. He was one that even his enemies said he did miracles. It was not just his apostles. It was not just his disciples that went out telling this. Even his enemies. The chief priests, therefore, and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What do we? For this man doeth many signs." Who is Jesus? He was a man who, during his time, performed many miracles and had a profound impact upon even his enemies. And one of the best passages on this that we might not at first think of, because the man I'm going to mention wasn't actually his enemy, but he belonged to those who usually were his enemies, the Pharisees. The man was Nicodemus. Nicodemus came to Jesus by night, and he said, "Rabbi, we know that thou art a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that thou doest except God be with him." So the enemies of Jesus themselves acknowledge that he does signs. And in John 12, John writes, "Yes, he did many signs, but even so his enemies would not believe. Though he did so many signs, yet they did not believe. But they did believe he did the signs." Now, isn't that a sight? They believed he did the signs. They had no illusions about whether he did the signs or not. Yes, he did the signs, but they did not believe that he was the Christ. They did not accept the conclusion of those signs. So, you know, as you think about this, here is a man who in his time did a multitude of signs right out in public in multitudes of people. He stilled the waters of the storm, the wind and the waves. He walked on the water. Oh, my. I stop for a moment and think about men as they explain these things. You see, there was this expert who said that in former times it was colder. Yeah, it was colder up there. Yeah, and sometimes the Sea of Galilee froze. Yeah, so Jesus was walking on ice. Yeah, right. Yeah, he was walking on ice. Cold enough to freeze the waters of the Sea of Galilee. You know how cold that is? And do you think that you would have over 5,000 men with the women and children out there the day before eating a feast as Jesus fed them with the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes. And whatever the ice was, Peter seemed to have trouble staying on it, didn't he? Because he sank. That's strange. That would have been some storm. Imagine a storm with a boat and the ice is frozen. The water is frozen. That's what happens when men begin to try to explain how it really happened. Their explanation is ludicrous, absurd, far more illogical than it would be merely to accept the record which says that He was the Son of God and He did a miracle. So, who is Jesus? He is someone that even His enemies admitted He did miracles. Turn to Matthew 27. 27:44. Who is Jesus? Jesus is someone who crucified on a cross, convinced a thief that was crucified with Him that He was going to receive a kingdom. Matthew 27, verse 44. And the robbers also that were crucified with Him cast upon Him the same reproach. Now, that's the verse we're starting with. Notice, and the robbers, that means both of them. There were only two. In all the records, there are only two others that are mentioned. So these would have to be the two. It doesn't say one of the robbers. It says, and the robbers also that were crucified with Him cast upon Him the same reproach. Turn over to Mark. Mark 15, verse 32. Mark 15, 32. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, because they were laughing at Him. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross, that we may see and believe. And they that were crucified with Him reproached Him. They that were crucified with Him reproached Him. Now I'm turning to Luke chapter 23 and verse 42. Let's begin in verse 39. And one of the malefactors that were hanged railed on Him, saying, Art not thou the Christ? Save thyself and us. But the other answered, and rebuking him, said, Dost thou not even fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man hath done nothing amiss. And he said, Jesus, remember me when thou comest in thy kingdom. And so if you will put yourself in the circumstance, and imagine you are a crucified thief, and you're on the cross hanging by another man who is crucified, what in the world would move you to ask that other man who's crucified to remember you when he comes in his kingdom? Who is Jesus? He is someone who convinced even a crucified thief that he would receive his kingdom. And in the same chapter, verse 47, who is Jesus? Jesus is someone whose death impressed the centurion that was standing by. We begin in verse 44. And it was now about the sixth hour, and the darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour, the sun's light failing, and the veil of the temple was rent in the midst. And Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said this, he gave up the ghost. And when the centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, Certainly this was a righteous man. Jesus was someone who could take the most ordinary of men and turn them into spiritual giants. I'm looking at Acts 4. In Acts 4, in Acts 3, Peter and John healed the lame man at the temple, at the gate called Beautiful. Peter preached to the multitude that gathered together. And then in chapter 4, they were taken into custody by the priest, the captain of the temple, and the Sadducees. And as they discussed the matter with them, in verse 13, Now when they beheld the boldness of Peter and John, and had perceived that they were unlearned, and ignorant men, they marveled. Huh. They're not acting like ignorant, unlearned men. These men are bold. And they're able to defend what they're doing and give cogent explanations of what they're doing. And they took knowledge of them that they had been with Jesus. What's the explanation for these men and for the transformation of these men? And it is so fascinating. You know, I can just go down the line one by one. I can go back, I can take, which one shall we take? What about John? Because John, I think everybody has good, kind feelings about John. John was a real good guy. I have no doubt John was a real good guy. But on one occasion, when they were passing through Samaria and Jesus asked for shelter, the Samaritans refused it. And John and his brother James said, "Lord, you want us to call down lightning from heaven on them?" And yet, John was transformed. And what about Peter? "Old Simon, your name shall be called Cephas." And Peter was a mix of the strong and the weak, like so many of us. He was the one that said to Jesus, "Though all the rest forsake thee, I will never forsake thee." And yet he did. He denied him three times. But when it was over, as Jesus said, "When thou art turned again, strengthen your brethren." And Peter did become such a fine and strong man. And so it is with all of these apostles. They were ordinary men. They were fishermen, tax collectors. One was a terrorist, and we don't even know what all of them were. But Jesus is one who could take the most ordinary of men and turn them into spiritual giants. So here's where we are. Just like the apostles, just like Pilate, just like Herod Antipas, and just like the Jewish council, you have a decision to make. What will you do with Jesus? Who is Jesus to you? What do you think Jesus is? What will you do with Jesus? We have said before that in the study of the Gospels, I don't think that we could have any reaction today about Jesus that was not reflected somewhere in the gospel account. Somebody has already had that reaction. But I think that sometimes today we don't realize maybe we are having the reaction. We don't see that. Because if I said to you, do you feel good about Jesus? Do you think Jesus was great? You think Jesus was awesome? And somebody would say, "Oh yeah, yeah." Well, what do you think about the people back there? "He came unto his own, and his own received him not." He came to the Jewish people, and his own Jewish people rejected him. And so you'd say, "Oh yeah, that was bad." What do you think about those scribes that could sit in the house where they lowered the palsied man right down through the hole in the roof, lowered him down here, and Jesus healed him right in front of them, and they would not believe that he's the Son of God. And instead they began thinking of thoughts like, Who does he think he is? Only God can forgive sins. How do you feel about them? Well, do you realize that as long as you are sitting there, maybe saying you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, maybe saying that you believe he is absolutely awesome and special and everything, and you're not becoming his follower, you're not becoming his disciple, then your affirmation of your love for him, or your faith for him, or your respect for him becomes a mockery. It becomes a mockery. You cannot have it both ways. And I know you wouldn't deliberately do that, but I want you to understand that is what you do. That's what you wind up doing. So it's a decision you have, you've got to make. What will you do with Jesus? And that's the song we're going to sing. And I want you to have that on your mind as we sing this song. And if you want to become a child of God, a follower of Jesus, what better time could there be than this to do it? To believe that He's the Son of God, turn away from sin, confess your faith, be baptized to have your sins removed. And if you're a child of God and you've been unfaithful, then repent and be restored. If we can assist you in either of these ways, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.